Thanks, Chris. MC Caton. Chris actually thinks that he's the smartest graduate from Adelaide University, but I'm sure the outgoing Secretary of the Treasury, Dr. Parkinson, probably thinks he's the smartest economics graduate from Adelaide University. Today what I want to do is talk about some of the global and domestic factors, as it says on the screen, that are influencing conditions in the Australian bond market. I'll start with a discussion on the decline in global bond yields that we've seen over the past year or so, before turning to focus on how these and other developments are played out in the Australian market. And then I'll finish with some recent and prospective regulatory developments which affect the local fixed income market. So let me just start with this. Yep. So we've got some bond yields here over the last couple of years, and I started in the beginning of 2014 when Treasuries had got to what I thought was a more reasonable price with a yield of around 3%. So at that yield, 3%, since the beginning of last year, investors were getting some compensation for a duration risk in the form of a term premium. So that is some compensation for uncertainty about the future direction of US monetary policy. But over the course of 2014, the yield declined steadily so that earlier this year it reached a low of just over around 164, which is around about the low point it got to in 2012. So with a yield of 164, investors were getting basically little or no compensation for term risk or the risk of inflation. Indeed, you have pretty reasonable estimates would say you were actually getting negative compensation for term risk. The term premium was actually negative. So there was no meaningful compensation at all for uncertainty about the path of US monetary policy or inflation. Those movements in the US yields were hardly unique. You also could see them in nearly all advanced economies and occurred despite some notable variations across countries at the shorter end of the curve. The pictures aren't very exciting, so you can probably do without them. Over recent months, it has looked more like yields in Germany actually have been driving those in the US rather than the traditional relationship going the other way of US yields driving everything else in the world. At least in the last couple of weeks, some of the decline in yields have been unwound in the US and a couple of other countries, but 10-year yields in the euro area, as you're probably all aware, have fallen further to reach new historic lows. 10-year yield in Germany actually now noticeably lower than those in Japan. So at the shorter end of the yield curve, rather than 10-year, so we've got the 2-year, so the left-hand side here for Germany, US, Japan and ourselves. Expectations for future monetary policy obviously are an important driver, and there's been a notable divergence in expectations for the path of monetary policy in major developed economies since the middle of last year. So in the US, the Fed gradually slowed the pace of its asset purchases from January last year and ceased them altogether in October. And more recently, it's getting closer to raising the level of the federal funds rate target for the first time in nearly a decade. So if you haven't been in financial markets for 10 years, you haven't seen a rise in US interest rates. So we'll see how that goes. In contrast, over the same period, the ECB has moved to further loosen monetary policy settings in the euro area, culminating with the announcement a few months ago of a sovereign bond purchase program. Moreover, several European countries that are not members of the euro area have lowered the interest rate paid on deposits with the central bank to negative territory, which is where the ECB itself has actually been since September last year, with minus 20. Meanwhile, the Bank of Japan obviously has continued its bond purchasing program and increasing the scale of that in October last year. So you can see there is some divergence at the front end of the curve there, with the US rates actually going up, while those in Germany and Japan going lower, and in Germany's case, actually turning negative. So at the other end of the curve, so I've got the five-year forward on the right-hand side for the same set of countries, you can see the movement has been much more uniform than it's been at the front end of the curve. So they've fallen consistently from around about the beginning of last year, and the uniformity of these movements suggests there's some sort of global factor playing a role. Now, while it's straightforward to come up with explanations for why yields have declined over the course of last year, I don't find any of them particularly good in explaining the size of the downward movement. So why did we get down to 164 in the US? So one explanation which people throw out is that the decline has been concerns about the global growth outlook. But if you actually look at forecasts either from consensus or at the IMF, they basically haven't changed. They actually haven't changed for about the last 3 years or so. So while people often put that out there, forecasts actually haven't changed that much at all. And in fact, in the US, they've actually been going up, not down. So secular stagnation is also another popular explanation, with lower real growth in the future implying lower real yields. I actually don't, that may well be the explanation. I don't think the world is actually as dire a place as that theory would suggest. Yields may have also been influenced by the prospective reduced supply of government bonds. The gradual, one thing which not everyone is completely aware of, but fiscal positions actually have been gradually improving over the last couple of years. And so that means that this year, the additional supply of bonds is less than it's been for quite some time, particularly noticeably in Germany, where the net issuance this year is actually not all that big at all. So you've got less supply coming to market. At the same time, the QE programs of the ECB and the BOJ have also worked to increase actual and anticipated demand for bonds. And there is an increased demand from banks to hold sovereign debt to meet liquidity requirements. So you have got reduced supply and increased demand going on. So the Fed obviously is no longer making net purchases, but at the same time, at least thus far, it said it's going to keep the stock of its holdings constant. They don't actually hold anything which matures any time in the next few years. So the supply, so their balance sheet is going to remain around about the same size as it is currently. So one remarkable outcome of all of this is that a large proportion of developed countries' government bonds are now actually trading at negative yields in secondary markets. Two-thirds of the German and Swiss government bonds on issue are currently trading at negative yields, while yields on bonds of up to 5 years in maturity from the Japanese and a variety of European governments have recently traded at negative yields, which I presume makes life interesting as a fixed income manager. Certainly does on our side as a reserve asset manager. Five-year forwards, as you can see there, have generally followed the trajectory of nominal yields but have declined by less over 2014. So with larger declines in nominal yields than real yields, estimated break-even rates, so here we've got the five-year forwards, estimated break-even rates have declined. But as you can see, they're not quite so large as the other declines. So one interpretation of this is that expectations for inflation have fallen considerably. And the oil price decline is often rolled out at this point. But oil prices should only, the decline in oil price should only reflect near-term inflation expectations. It should only account for a very small decline in medium-term inflation expectations, because the oil price only gets to fall by that amount once. It doesn't keep on doing it again and again. So a substantial decline in medium-term inflation expectations is much more difficult to explain. And in particular, if you look at survey-based estimates of inflation expectations from consumers, they don't appear to have declined much at all beyond the near-term effect of the oil prices. Moreover, the decline in inflation expectations isn't actually a universal phenomenon like the other ones I was talking about. In Australia, break-even inflation rates were broadly flat over the second half of 2014 and are around about where they should be if you believe our inflation target. So finally, in terms of an explanation, one potential one that I've only briefly discussed a few minutes ago is that yields are being held down by a shortage of risk-free assets as demand for these assets has increased, particularly from the financial sector. So there's some interesting recent work by Ricardo Caballero at MIT and also by Zoltan Pozsar, who's now at Credit Suisse, what used to be at the New York Fed, looking at this sort of large increase in demand for risk-free assets and the potential global shortage of them. So I think that one probably stands the best chance of explaining why we've seen such a large decline in yields. So you've got increased demand, reduced supply. So supply and demand often gets you a fair way. But even so, term premia are unusually compressed. And as I said, it's arguable you're getting any compensation for term in yields at the moment. So if you're buying these assets because they're risk-free, it would appear to me that there's not a free that there is a reasonable risk that the term premium is actually going to rise at some point, which would engender a fair bit of volatility in the price and probably doesn't leave them quite as risk-free as you thought in the first place. So anyway, I think that is something which remains a conundrum in the bond market, to use a much overused expression, and we'll see how that plays out over the rest of this year. So let me turn to the domestic market. And the one reason why I went through all those global developments is if you're looking at the domestic market, it's generally useful to think about it in a global context, which is not something that everyone always does. We are not immune from what's been going on in the rest of the world. So those global factors have contributed to an large decline in our bond yields as well, to the point where we got the 10-year yield down to the lowest we've seen in history at around 2.42. At the shorter end, obviously, the February reduction in the cash rate and associated repricing and market expectations has also seen a decline in yield. So the three-year yield has also fallen there. And we've still seen that strong historical correlation between Australian and US yields, but at the same time, the spread between the two, as I'm sure you're all aware, has narrowed considerably over the past year, declining from around 100 basis points in the middle of last year to be as low as 40 basis points recently. Again, if you look at movements in bond yields over the last few months, it looks as much as though German yields are driving those in Australia as it is the US yields. So, as I said, that outcome has seen the 10-year yield decline to a low actually of 2.28% recorded in February, the lowest in the country's history. These declines in CGS yields have occurred notwithstanding some increase in supply, but at the same time, and something again to put in global in the context of debt positions of everywhere else in the world, Australia still has the lowest stock of debt outstanding of almost any developed economy. And considerably less than another number of other countries which still maintain a AAA rating. So while the stock of debt has gone up, as I said, as this shows, it's still considerably less than pretty much anywhere else in the world, beyond one or two exceptions. The vast majority of the post-crisis CGS issuance has been purchased by non-residents, attracted to the government's AAA rating, and the favourable level of yields relative to those in other sovereign issuers. So we actually have positive yields, which obviously is a little more attractive than negative yields. So what we're seeing is a very large increase in the non-resident holdings of CGS. That's that orange line on the left-hand panel. So you've seen that go up sixfold since late 2007 and peaked at just under 80% of the total stock outstanding in 2010. You can see from the graph it's declined a bit over 2011 and 2012. That wasn't because of any net selling, it was just that the buying didn't quite keep pace with the issuance. But then over the last year or so, it's actually been relatively stable. So the increase foreign holdings of government debt has actually been reflected in the notable change in the composition of the country's foreign liabilities. So what I've got here is the stock of foreign liabilities as a share of GDP, which has remained pretty much steady at around 55% for the better part of two decades. But you can see there that the foreign holdings of government debt currently account for a much larger share than they have for quite some time. And obviously back in the 90s, all these numbers were a hell of a lot smaller than they are today. So we've seen a marked change in the composition of the country's net foreign liabilities. Now about over one third of it, in net terms at least, is accounted for by foreigners' holdings of government debt. And the major factor which has changed on the other side is smaller holdings by foreigners of bank debt. Roughly exactly offsetting the increase of foreign holdings of government debt. Turning to developments in the semis market, where yields have fallen by more than those on CGS, so we're seeing secondary market spreads down to around 30 basis points. So state governments are also able to borrow at rates under 3%, clearly the lowest they've been ever able to borrow at. In terms of ownership, I'll just flick back a bit. So you can see here that foreign ownership actually hasn't increased in terms of semis. Again, mostly not necessarily because of any large net selling, but just mostly because it hasn't kept pace with issuance. But what has increased is the share of semis held by banks, which has risen from a fairly small number to be just over 40% currently. So this is a consequence, as you're probably all aware, of banks' desires to hold much more HQLA, high-quality liquid assets, in the aftermath of the global financial crisis, and more recently, from the beginning of this year at least, the liquidity coverage ratio that came into effect in Australia at the beginning of 2015. So APRA has determined that the Australian banking system needs to hold around just over $400 billion of HQLA from the beginning of this year. And of this amount, and this they took under on our advice, the Reserve Bank's advice, around $175 billion could be met through holding CGS and semis. And given the higher yield on semis than CGS, the banks have not surprisingly decided to hold more of that in the form of semis than in CGS. Our assessment is that any greater holdings by the banks of semis would undermine the purpose of the LCR by making those instruments illiquid. So we've come up, try to have, you know, it's not a hell of a lot of science behind this, We'll try to come up with a number where we don't think it's going to impair the liquidity of the underlying market. As I said, if the banks held any more than that, then they would basically be counterproductive. So the introduction of the LCR has proceeded smoothly, as best as we can tell. But obviously over the course of this year and into the future, we'll continue to monitor developments in the market to ensure that liquidity conditions remain broadly appropriate. So let me now turn to some regulatory developments in the market, and particularly ones which are affecting the local fixed income market. So one global development that has garnered a lot of comment of late is the effect of reduced market making capacity in fixed income. This is a global development as much as a local one. As Chris mentioned earlier, I'm on a BIS committee, the CGFS, and we put out a paper, and you can see the reference on the electronic version of this speech, which discussed these developments. We issued it late last year. And in the RBA bulletin, which I think is coming out either this week or next, John Cheshire, one of my staff, who was on the working group, the BIS working group, which looked at this issue, is assessing these developments both globally but also particularly in the local market. So that report documented the intended effect of regulation in bringing down this reduction in market-making capacity. So the fact that it's reduced, that was actually intended. There is a debate as to whether the reduction has gone too far, but the fact it's lower is what was actually intended. Liquidity risk was clearly underpriced pre-crisis. As I said, whether it's now overpriced, don't know. That's a discussion one can have, but it was clearly underpriced. The fact that it's more expensive now was the intention. And rather than describing it as a reduction in market making, I actually think it's more useful to think of it as a reduction in the risk absorption capacity of intermediaries. The ability of intermediaries to warehouse portfolio adjustments of asset managers is curtailed. So in the past, if you needed to adjust your portfolio, you could ring up the rates desk and try and offload something to them, and then you'd rig up the MBS desk and try and offload something to them of the same institution, and each desk would have their own limit. Now, those limits generally are applied holistically right across the trading desk. So if you ring up the rates desk and try to offload something to them, you might be able to do that, and then when you ring up the MBS desk, they'll say, sorry, my capacity to take on any more risk across the whole portfolio is reduced because you offloaded that part of your portfolio to another part of the desk. So the intermediaries are now applying risk holistically across the whole trading desk rather than just desk by desk. And that holistic limit is lower than it was in the past. So asset managers need to take account of these changes in market dynamics in thinking about how they adjust their portfolios. Transaction costs are higher, and in particular, liquidity costs are higher. I'm not sure that everyone has fully appreciated this yet, and they still think that they can adjust their portfolios the way they did in 2007. That isn't the case. The second development to note is in the asset-backed security space. So as many of you know, as of 30 June this year, the RBA will introduce mandatory reporting requirement for asset-backed securities to be repo eligible with us. We're continuing to work with the industry to ensure the timely implementation of these requirements. The required information, which will also be made available to permitted users, will promote greater transparency in the market. These requirements, from our point of view, will also provide us with standardised and detailed data on asset-backed securities, and given they're an important part of the collateral eligible to be used under the CLF, gives us a lot more information to be able to assess and price those instruments. So in preparation for the introduction of these reporting requirements and to facilitate industry readiness, the reporting system for people to be able to report data on ABS to us was made available to industry in November last year. And we started with voluntary reporting accepted from 31st of December last year. We're currently working with a number of institutions undertaking test submissions, with some institutions expecting to commence regular reporting shortly. Everyone has to do reporting by 30 June. And so you're strongly encouraged to actually undertake the testing before we get to the compulsory reporting as of 30 June to make sure that you're ready on your side. We are certainly ready on our side to accept people's submissions whenever they want. After 30 June, securities without the required information won't be repo eligible, so that gives people a bit of incentive to get it done. The third development I'll talk about is the proposed changes to the settlement convention to T plus 2 for OTC transactions in domestic fixed income securities. So we strongly encourage this initiative. The current standard of T plus 3 settlement in the Australian market doesn't stack up with where everyone else in the world is at on this, with most other jurisdictions already progressing to shorter settlement cycles, including even T plus 1, for OTC transactions in their domestic fixed income markets. A shorter settlement cycle will reduce the risks associated with settlement, in particular counterparty risk. Market makers in OTC fixed income securities may particularly benefit from the reduced period of counterparty exposure, as any given trade will count towards internal credit limits for a shorter period of time, which potentially goes some way, although possibly only a little way, to offsetting that overall reduction in market making capacity I was talking about a second ago. Moving to T plus 2 is likely to encourage straight-through processing, which could reduce the risk of an operational issue affecting the settlement of OTC fixed income securities. Ideally, that shift to T plus 2, we would like it to be implemented by the end of this year. Finally, let me just talk briefly about interest rate benchmarks in the local market. So the RBA, together with ASIC, is working with the industry through AFMA, as some of you are aware, to develop a robust risk-free interest rate benchmark in the local market, probably based on OIS. Once this is operational, this will help support a movement of products towards referencing a risk-free benchmark. At the moment, BBSW, the credit benchmark, is referenced in a very large number of securities, including a large number of products which shouldn't be referencing, ideally, a credit-based benchmark. So this is part of a global initiative under the auspices of the Financial Stability Board of A, developing a risk-free benchmark, and B, transiting a number of products away from credit benchmarks like LIBOR or locally BBSW towards these risk-free benchmarks. As I said, we're working with AFMA and ASIC on this, and hopefully something will come to fruition in this respect later this year. So let me finish by noting that there are a large number of moving parts in fixed income at the moment. A number of international and domestic factors are having an important influence on Australian bond markets. The low level of yields globally and domestically, I think, are difficult to explain, most notably the very low level of term premium, and in fact, possibly negative level of the term premium. I don't find most of the explanations which are put out there particularly compelling in explaining the size of the move. They can explain the direction, but not the size. Though I think potentially the overall shortage of, in quotes, risk-free assets has probably got a fair bit to do with what we're seeing out there at the moment. So at the same time as you're coming together, grappling with those developments, investors need to be aware of the changed market dynamics in terms of how you adjust your portfolios. There are higher transaction costs in fixed income out there. The capacity to shift a large amount of stock in a short period of time is almost certainly reduced. So you need to factor that in the higher cost of liquidity provision, the higher cost of portfolio adjustment into your decision making. Doesn't make life necessarily any easier, but as I said, we're not, you know, the fact that conditions are not what they were in 2007 in terms of portfolio adjustment is actually the intent. That is not an accident. So people need to be aware of those higher transaction costs and factor that into their decision making. So let me finish there and happy to take questions on any or none of that. So thanks.
There are some questions that are coming from the audience.
You mean on the messaging thing or actual from real people? Okay. Yeah, okay, thanks, Lawrence.
First question is, if there was a sell-off in global bond yields, could this also lead to precipitous falls in equity markets, as those markets suggest the low discount?
I don't know what's priced into equity markets at the moment, to be honest. Depends why bond yields sell off. If it's because the global outlook actually looks better, then arguably that validates equity market pricing. But one could consider that there's probably not, you know, the discount rate across all asset classes is probably reasonably low at the moment. So if the discount rate goes up in fixed income or the term premium goes up in fixed income markets, you might see the same sort of thing in other asset markets. But predicting the future direction of asset prices, which is what you guys are all paid to do, is fraught. Yeah. Yes.
The next question is, I've got a mic now. With 10-year real yields near zero and even negative, have bonds lost their usefulness in determining what growth will be in the long term?
Well, that's partly what I was talking about today. So if you, I still think the crudest and most useful way of working out where bond yields will be in the medium term is something around about, in nominal terms at least, is nominal GDP with a discount. Still think that probably works. And so in real terms, it's real GDP with some adjustment for a discount rate. As I was saying earlier, I think the thing which has moved the most is that discount rate or the scarcity premium for fixed income. That if you can work out what that premium actually is, and you can still back that out to work out what expectations are about medium-term growth developments. But the problem, the most troublesome part of that equation is working out what that discount rate is. That's almost certainly changed, whether it's changed temporarily or permanent. I think that's the open question.
There are a couple more through the interactivity feature, but we should probably see if there's anyone in the audience who wants to raise a hand before I do the last couple here. Get a microphone.
Mr. Robertson.
Here. There'll be a microphone on its way.
Guy, you mentioned that anyone who hasn't been in markets for a decade probably hasn't seen a big tightening. Is it credible for the Fed to tighten when their inflation, current inflation is 1.2%? That seems to be one of the things that people are anxious about, that inflation in the US is much lower than it used to be. It's not obviously about to rise. And, Fed hiking, is not on everyone's radar, but because inflation is so low and everything's so stable.
I don't want to get in predicting what other central banks are going to do, but the only thing which slightly surprises me if I look at market pricing at the moment is, as best as I can tell, the Fed rhetoric on what they're intending to do has been pretty much exactly the same for the last 6 months. Now, whether people listen to that is up to them, but I would generally listen to someone who's actually got control over what they're actually going to do. But the rhetoric hasn't changed. Broadly speaking, the data has validated the rhetoric. Inflation is a little low at the moment. A fair chunk of that is to do with lower oil prices. As I said earlier, oil prices, I don't think, are going to keep on falling by 50% or by in a short period of time from over the next few years. So the effect of oil prices on inflation probably is temporary. That's again, if you listen to what the Fed says, that's what they're expecting. So I don't understand market pricing around the Fed's decision. I won't try to validate it or invalidate it. But all I would say is I would probably listen to the people who actually have control over what they're actually going to do and hear what they're saying and base my expectations around that.
Maybe just time for one more. There are too many to get through, so apologies to people who aren't getting questions answered, but there's at least a dozen on here. So let's end with, would Guy buy German bonds today?
Well, so we have bunds in our reserves portfolio. So the answer to that question is we do hold them. As I said, it's an interesting challenge for reserve managers, just as it is for other asset managers, what you do, how you think about negative yields. I mean, we hold the level of reserves we do for a reason, which is to give us the capacity, for a number of reasons, but including to intervene in the market. If those reserves are shrinking, probably doesn't mean that we've got, that's a consideration we have to take into account. So it is something which we have to think about, and as I said, it's a challenge for us and other reserve managers, just as it is for asset managers in general.
Okay, we might just have time for one more. I know the Q&A is valued by a lot of people, and there's a lot here. So final one, definitely. You say there's a debate on whether reduced market making has gone too far. What's your view?
The point I was trying to get is, I think that's an open question. My view, I don't think, if we see a sell-off in markets, coming back to Rory's question, when the Fed raises rates, undoubtedly that will be blamed on the reduced capacity of market making, even though when market making capacity was larger in 94, we still had a pretty decent sell-off then as well. So it will be blamed for a lot of things which it isn't actually responsible for and would have happened regardless. As I said, some reduction in market making capacity was the intent. Liquidity provision or market making provision of market making services was underpriced in 2007. Whether it's now too expensive now or more fairly priced, I think, is debatable. So I think, as I said, I think it's very much an open question. The other thing I suppose I'd point out is that some of that reduction in market making capacity was the effect of regulation. Some of it was because banks just decided this wasn't a profitable business line to be in anymore. Now, again, indirectly or directly because of regulation. But not all of it is a function of the regulatory environment. I said, I think we'll have to wait and see. Seeing what happens when the Fed raises rates, I don't think it's actually going to be a good test of the overall market-making capacity of the system. The other thing which I think needs to be taken into account is there are a number of market initiatives going on, particularly buy-side to buy-side trading, and particularly in the fixed income space, and particularly in the electronic fixed income space, which are moving to reduce some of those transaction costs. Electronic trading in fixed income, particularly in anything outside standardised products like treasuries, is still, I would say, in its infancy. And we're going to see quite a lot of evolution on that front over the next year or two, which will affect overall transaction costs and will affect the way that fixed income asset managers can go about adjusting their portfolios in the future. So, you know, just because there's a reduction in capacity on one side doesn't mean the overall capacity is necessarily going to be reduced. And particularly, as I said, you know, bypassing the intermediaries and going much more buy-side to buy-side, I think, is almost certainly going to be a much bigger feature of the fixed income landscape than it has been in the past, which will mitigate some of that reduction in overall market-making capacity.